always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. The FDA has decided to limit access to COVID vaccines later this year. Dr. William Schaffner of Vanderbilt University.
It is targeting the vaccine to older persons, people age 65 and older, and those younger who have underlying medical conditions.
Vaccine makers will now need to conduct major new clinical trials before approving them for wider use. In New Orleans, CBS's Katie Weiss says someone who works at a jail where 10 inmates escaped from last week is under arrest.
Investigators say 33-year-old Sterling Williams, a maintenance worker at the Orleans Parish Prison, turned off the water to the cell. The prisoners, using a tool, then removed a toilet and sawed through steel bars to break out.
Several states are under threat of severe weather yet again. That includes Kentucky, where Andy Beshear is governor.
That storm that is coming in tonight is incredibly dangerous.
Storms over the weekend killed at least 29 people. CBS News Brief. I'm Matt Piper.
Hi, this is Beth, host of The Kitchen's Open. Join us each Monday morning at the top of the 10 o'clock hour for tips, tricks, and a whole lot of fun. The Kitchen's Open, only on WFHR.
It's the Brewers in Baltimore. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball tonight, the Brewers and Orioles for game two of their three-game series. The crew winning 5-4 last night, thanks to an RBI single from William Contreras, who despite a fractured middle finger on his left hand, had four hits in the game, tying a career high. Pat Murphy.
Hitters don't use their baby fingers that much. They might be on the bat, but these are the two fingers on each hand you hit with. So the pressure of that when you turn the bat over too soon or hit it off the end, the vibration on that is tough.
NBA, Giannis Antetokounmpo scheduled to meet with the Bucks about his future with the team. His older brother, Thanasis, says he's been cleared to play again after suffering that torn Achilles last year. Former Badgers John Tanjay, one of the top five scorers during drills at the NBA Combine in Chicago.
You know, to see myself near the top of that leaderboard was pretty amazing. It was kind of surprising. I thought I didn't shoot it too well just because I want to make every single shot.
That's Wisconsin's John Tanjay with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
I love playing sports, especially for my school. And that's because school sports are special. It's where it's safe to fail. It's where we're taught resilience, where our fear becomes confidence. It's where we learn to get back up after every fall. School sports are where 7.8 million students go from I can't to I can.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to start off with J.D. Vance. And look, I don't think I've, in all the years I've been doing this program, I don't think I've been as angry at any one person as I am at J.D. Vance's most recent, I don't even know what to call it, to be honest. President Biden, the announcement was stage four cancer. And J.D. Vance is the guy who... Yeah, the thing is, you can't forget who J.D. Vance really is. Before he groveled his way into MAGA world, he was the guy who trashed Donald Trump at every opportunity, called him reprehensible, compared him to Hitler, straight up called Trump an idiot. That's who J.D. Vance was before he sold his soul at a shot for power. Now, this same phony, currently sitting in the vice president's chair, has the audacity to pretend like he cares about President Biden's cancer diagnosis, seriously? Only to then immediately pivot into some smug political attack? He said that, we need to be honest about whether the former president was capable of doing the job. I mean, honestly, the corpse isn't even cold yet. And they're already piling on. And he goes, he goes into this, almost like he cares about something, but completely self-serving. Where the heck was J.D. Vance's honesty when Trump was ranting about bleach or rigged elections. Where was he when he stared blankly into space, mixing up Nikki Haley with Nancy Pelosi or trying to overturn democracy of himself? Where was JD then? Now JD Vance wants to act like he's the voice of reason, shows his concern. The guy's a fraud, a coward who flipped every value he may have once ever claimed to have held simply to grab his little greasy palms onto some bit of power. Now he's exploiting President Biden's cancer, which sadly has metastasized into his bones, and Vance is using this as a political weapon. Yeah, President Biden's health is serious. Stage 4 prostate cancer is no joke. But do you really think J.D. Vance cares? Do you think J.D. Vance cares about truth or transparency? No, he only cares about controlling the narrative. The GOP is already baying for blood, calling for investigations into who knows what and when. We're going to have another Benghazi, only then this time it's going to be Biden, Biden, Biden. Look, I believe transparency matters, but don't let J.D. Vance gaslight you into thinking that this is about public trust. This is about scoring points off of an 82-year-old man's cancer diagnosis. And while Vance is cozying up to the man he once warned would destroy the country, you know, Trump, the same Trump whose debates Biden supposedly flubbed, as if Trump himself didn't spend those same debates babbling like a moron, like a man unmoored from reality. And now J.D. Vance sits on Air Force Two, giving sanctimonious lectures about fitness for office, pretending he's some moral compass. Don't go anywhere near the couches, folks. J.D. was there. Spare us the nonsense. This, pure and simple, is political grave dancing from a man who once had a spine, but has now traded it for MAGA merch and proximity to power. Screw J.D. Vance. And understand, he ain't got it. He's not Trump. Everyone said, oh, he's the heir apparent. No, no spine. I don't even think the right has any respect for him. And this is sadly the world that we're in. The spineless, the unscrupulous. These are the people running our country. What's really angering is that this is just another day. And look, I like Joe Biden. I did. He wasn't my first choice for president. He was my fourth. I thought he did a very good job. I thought he was a transformational president. Had we been able to carry that on? Trump's destroying all of that. I thought Biden was moving the ship in the right direction. I thought, you know, the policies that he got through, in 20 years, we're going to look back at and go, wow, that wish we would have stuck with that. But no, the price of eggs was more important. So we end up with charlatans, cowards, and J.D. freaking Vance. The hope, and I keep coming back to this, the hope is that at some point we wake up to the reality that these people don't care about workers, don't care about this country. They care about themselves. They care about their bottom line. They care about their egos. You look at this plane thing. And look, I knew the plane thing was about stealing headlines. It was about getting people all worked up. Because Trump comes from the old school thought, the Hollywood thought process of there's no such thing as bad publicity. There's no such thing as when someone's saying your name that it's bad for you. So you throw out a bunch of stuff and see who bites. And the fact that, you know, you've got this big, beautiful jet that we were going to get for free. And people saying this is a bad idea. You've got others like J.D. Vance, like Mark Wayne Mullen, like a bunch of Republicans doing backflips to justify it. And now I guess this is Biden's fault too somehow. You know, they were talking about this during the Biden years. You know what didn't happen during the Biden years? They didn't take it. Trump wants it. And now I guess he's talking about suing ABC for saying that it would go to him, when the reality is it would go to his presidential library. Everybody knows that. And he would get to use it. So is it him? Yeah. But again, what we're seeing is cowardice all across this country. And we're allowing people like J.D. Vance, people like Donald Trump, to get away with all of this. And I agree with Mike Johnson, you know, when he said, you know, we called them the Biden crime family because, you know, they were doing stuff behind closed doors. They still haven't told us what it really is. Lots of allegations. But Mike Johnson said, you know, all of what Trump does, he's doing it right in front of us. He's robbing us blind right in front of us. It's what Republicans have learned. If you're going to steal, do it out in public where everyone sees it, and then rub our nose in it when they steal it. Gonna take a quick break. When we come back, let's see if they're going to steal Medicaid and how many poor people are going to die because of it. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, looks like the big, beautiful bill is moving somewhat forward. And Republicans appear to be moving forward with the work requirement mandate. As I understand it, 80 hours a week to qualify for Medicaid. But never mind the reality that the Kaiser Family Foundation came up with a statistic that said like 92% of adults who are on Medicaid in 2023 are working. I think that's the number. So it's another one of those situations. If facts be damned, reality be damned, we need another roadblock. We need more obstacles. And while screaming about efficiency and all of that, creating massive bureaucracy and inefficiency. I'm here to share some thoughts on, well, where the things are and where hopefully they do not go. I've asked Andrew Dukas to come talk with us. Andrew is the vice president of health policy there at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org, their website. Andrea, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, glad to be here.
So where are we with this? I understand the work mandate, the work requirements there, which interestingly enough, I have a lot of friends who are like, well, you should have to work, you know, because I got to work. And look, there's something to that. Thoughts?
Yeah. So just to back up a second and share where we are, Congress is in the middle of trying to bring the one big, beautiful bill to the House floor later this week. There's a complex process that goes into getting it to the House floor. Right now, where the bill is that it's getting ready to go to the Rules Committee, which will be having its markup at 1 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday. That's when they decided to do this, 1 a.m., totally normal thing to do with
like
a bill you're
proud
night.
Of.
Yeah, totally normal thing to do with a bill you're proud of. Went to the Budget Committee last night at 10 p.m. Also, again, totally normal. But yeah, one of the provisions in this bill, and the purpose of this bill, just to remind everybody, is to help pay for continuing tax cuts that primarily benefit the wealthy. One of the provisions in this bill would force people who are on Medicaid, or a set of people who are on Medicaid, to prove either that they have a job or that they, you know, have caregiving responsibilities, which, as you said, you know, sounds reasonable on its face, except for a couple of things. One, as you correctly stated, the vast majority of people, 92% of people on Medicaid, if they're not working, they are in school, they are caregiving, they have an illness, they would not be people who would even be subject to this, right? So only 8% of people on Medicaid, according to KFF data, are not working for some reason that's not related to other responsibilities. So they might have retired early. They might have some other illness or inability to work that is not, you know, a documented disability. But it's a very, very tiny sliver of the population. Additionally, every single time states who administer their own Medicaid programs have tried to do something like this in the past, where they go to the government and they ask for permission to do things differently in their states, it's been a complete and total disaster. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people lose their coverage. And these are people who are eligible for the program, who would not have been kicked off because they didn't meet the requirement. It's just because they couldn't get through the red tape. Which makes sense. I mean, you think about this as a saving strategy, right? Like, if the goal of this provision in this bill is to generate hundreds of billion dollars in savings, the only way to do that is if eligible people lose their coverage.
Right.
That is the only goal behind this, is to put as many hurdles, as much paperwork, as much confusion into this process as possible, that people just give up and they lose their coverage.
The thing that's interesting to me is government is the backstop. And this is what I keep trying to explain to my friends. Government's the backstop of all private interests, of everything that goes on in this country. The government is at the bottom of the hill. And as the saying goes, you know, what rolls downhill ends up at the bottom of the hill. And this is where government has to be the backstop in all this. So anytime I hear Republicans say savings, we're going to save money from a program like Medicaid or Medicare, to me it means the last resort is being taken away and the only option are people dying. Or the rest of society in a different way is going to have to pick up for it, just in a different way that they can claim, hey, look what we did, while shifting responsibility. Now, look, I'm not against private interests, you know, big corporations having to pay more. If that were the case, the sad reality is I know it's the weakest among us who end up carrying the burden, and the voiceless who end up carrying the burden. And that's all this is to me.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if you think about it, so we're right now in the middle of doing an analysis. We're adding up how much money basically hospitals and health centers are going to have to eat in uncompensated care costs, right? Charity care. And it's almost the amount of money this bill is saving, right? Like, the care needs don't go away. Putting a work requirement on somebody doesn't make their cancer diagnosis disappear, right? They're still going to need health care. It's just not going to be paid for anymore. Right. So who's going to be left holding the bag? It's going to be providers. It's going to be hospitals. It's going to be states, right, who already have strained budgets. And but you're exactly right. That's where the burden's going to fall. Right. Like, yeah. Again, we don't have like magical thinking. If you take people's health insurance away, it doesn't mean that they get healthier.
No, of course not. But it's this kind of tip of the nose thinking of we're saving money without thinking. Well, let's use the slippery slope argument. I hear this all the time. We're going to make a legislation, to restrict, people with mental health records from owning guns or whatever you want to. Slippery slope. We don't make that argument about taking health care away from people. We don't make that about slashing government programs, which are the bottom, the safety net that keeps people from dying on the streets. We never hear that argument.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating. It's sort of like the piece that was written by Dr. Oz and Secretary Kennedy, and going out there and describing Medicaid as welfare. So it's like, is any government provided service welfare? Is like public school welfare?
Tax
like,
cuts for the rich.
What are we doing here?
It's very rare that I'm speechless, but the more I listen to these people talk, and the more they say the quiet part out loud, the more I'm not surprised that they're saying it. I'm not surprised that they feel emboldened by it. I'm surprised that we're taking it.
Yeah.
I guess that's where I'm
at. I mean, and I would argue that we aren't. When we last chatted, I talked about how unpopular this bill is, right? People don't want the Medicaid program slashed. This is why this markup hearing is happening at 1 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday. This is why the budget hearing happened last night after 10 p.m., right? This is very purposeful. The point is, let's rush and do this as quickly as humanly possible. Let's do it without CBO scores. Let's do it while in the Energy and Commerce Committee markup, you actually have Republican House members saying, that's in this bill? Are you sure? Oh, I didn't know that. Right? And they're going to vote on it anyway. No, but they're going to make sure that they do it in the middle of the night when nobody's paying attention.
Right, like thieves in the night, literally. But you hit on something there that's kind of comical to me. Because these are the people who were complaining and whining that bills were too big and complicated that helped people, that they need to slow the process down. And yet, a bill that's going to literally harm millions of people, we're going to rush through like thieves in the night without actually reading.
Mm-hmm. And without even knowing what the full implications are. We don't even have full CBO scores.
There are days where I go, I can't believe where we are, and this is it. I've said this a couple of times over the last several months. You'd have asked me 10 years ago if we were a country willing to allow people to die on the street corner. Because I probably told you the story back in 2011 when Governor Tom Corbett here in Pennsylvania wanted to cut the Health and Human Services budget by half. There was a woman I met from ADAPT who said, look, if they're going to kill me, they're going to have to watch me die right here in the halls of the Capitol. And I'm like, no, we're not going to allow that to happen. And I would have fought anybody who said that we were that country. I don't know now. I don't know that a large portion of this population isn't willing to let that happen.
Yeah, I mean, what's been really grotesque about this process is just watching how flippantly people talk about this, right? Like, oh, you know, we're just trying to do X. We're just trying to save money. Like, it's very disingenuous, right? The House Republican members know what they're doing. They know what's going to happen as a result of this bill. And it really does not seem to bother them, which is disturbing. There's one, I'm just going to give you one example of like one piece of this legislation, which I think is really striking in its cruelty, right? So if you are one of those people who is subject to work requirements, so these are adults in the Medicaid expansion population, right? If you're subject to work requirements and you can't get through the red tape, you miss some sort of data upload or you're having issues with your computer. I don't know what it is, right? But you can't meet the red tape. And so you get kicked off of Medicaid. Well, there's actually a piece in this legislation that would then prohibit you from getting a tax credit to even buy coverage on your own in the private ACA marketplace. You're not even allowed to do that, right? Like, that is how gross this is, right? And I don't know how much more transparent you can be than saying we're going to take away any affordable coverage option from somebody who fails to meet this red tape. Not only that, actually, there's one other piece, which is that for the very first time, this bill would also force states to charge co-pays and out-of-pocket costs to very low-income people. Again, these are people at 100% of the federal poverty line. For a family of three, that's like $27,000. So forcing people in that family to potentially have to pay co-pays. Imagine if they have a kid that is asthmatic or diabetic or a parent with cancer, and every specialist, right, is going to potentially charge them up to $35. I mean, that's an extreme burden on a family that is before taxes making $26,000, $27,000 a year.
But they got to have skin in the game, Andrea. We just can't be giving away free healthcare, because understand that message resonates with working people. Because look, I got to do it. Why shouldn't they have to do it? But they don't go to the next statement. You know, $30 for someone making $50,000 a year is a lot different than someone making $25,000 a year, or someone making $75,000. I've said there should be none of those things. I'm a single payer guy. I think we should have one giant insurance pool. Everybody's in it. And we talk about efficiency. It would be much more efficient. But we're never going to do that because the moneyed interests don't want that. So we end up having these games where the think tank world, the right-wing think tank world, gets to game out all these horrible ideas. And, well, we're seeing them on display.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So I do want to focus on the work requirement thing, because it is, you ask anyone, they're going to go, well, yeah, you should have to work. And there's only 8% of the people who aren't in that. Is there a way to, if they pass this, to amend somehow and go, look, okay, I want people to work. But maybe, like where I grew up, we weren't on the bus line. There were no jobs. private sector didn't create enough and was never going to create enough jobs. Isn't this a place where the public sector, where government should step in and say, okay, we're going to create jobs for those 8% of people to make sure that they do meet the requirements?
I mean, again, I think something that's worth noting once more is that most people on Medicaid who can work are already working, and they're working in jobs that don't provide benefits. Right. So like, what is the purpose of the Medicaid program? It is to make sure that low income people have access to health care. That is the point. Even working people. Right.
Right.
If everybody in the program were working in a low wage job that's not offering benefits, we would still need the Medicaid program because those jobs don't offer benefits. So this gets back to the point of what do we think that we owe our society, right? What kind of a society do we want? Not only with respect to whether we want to make sure that everybody in this country has access to health insurance, but you also want to make sure that providers, hospitals, clinics in your communities are financially solvent and financially sustainable and aren't going broke because they're being they're in a position where so many of the people who are coming to see them can't pay.
That's an excellent point. And you look at rural communities who, from what I understand, they're going to be hit hardest by this because they need that base income to stay afloat. I mean, rural hospitals are closing, and the threat of more of them closing if this happens is substantial. So even if you do have insurance in one of those rural areas and there's nowhere to go, does it matter?
Yeah, that's a great point. And we're very, very, very worried about that, too. I mean, we put out a report a few weeks ago just looking at how many hospitals in this country are at immediate risk of closure. That's like right now their financial situation is so precarious that they could really close at any time. And there are close to 200 of those in states that have expanded Medicaid. So these are the states where, you know, the work requirements like will have the biggest effect. I really worry about those types of facilities being pushed over the edge.
And this is, again, back to my original statement about the slippery slope. Once you start going down this hill, it only gets worse faster. And not just for the people that are the target of this, but for everybody else, because that domino effect, once you take this money out of the rural hospitals, then they start looking to cut costs. That means you have an assault on workers' wages, on nursing, on quality of care, on staffing, on all of that stuff, until eventually it closes and, well, we're all worse off. And again, the comment, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I don't believe there are any good intentions here. So I guess, how do we amend that? If the road to hell is paved with good intentions, what is this paved with?
Oh my gosh. Cynicism and contempt for the working class is what I would say. I mean, really, again, if your goal, and I don't believe this is true, but if the goal here is like, we just want to get people to work, which again, I don't think is true because the vast majority of people on Medicaid who can work are already working. So I don't think that this is a problem they really believe they need to solve. But even if that were true, wouldn't you want to make sure that the labor force was healthy and had the ability to show up and give their all to their jobs, right? Why would you want to take that away from them? It's just mind-boggling. And again, I think the most transparent thing about this is the only reason work requirements are in this bill is to save money. They cannot save money unless people lose coverage. If everybody could meet the work requirements, $0 would be saved. But they're banking on millions and millions and millions of people getting cut from the rolls because that's the only way to generate the savings in the bill.
Yeah, and again, I come back to what I said from the beginning. That just means that will be shifted somewhere else. Hospitals will have to take on uncompensated care, which means people with regular private insurance through their employer or wherever, their costs are going to go up. It's not like, and I'm hoping I'm wrong, I hope we're not going to let people just die on the street corner.
And we've been talking a lot about Medicaid work reporting requirements. That's only one piece that's in this bill. There are also other changes in this bill that would make insurance through the ACA more expensive, that would make it harder for people to access, During the markups, the House Republicans voted down an amendment that would have actually extended the enhanced tax credits that people are getting that are expiring at the end of the year to buy their ACM marketplace coverage. And if those expire, another 5 million people or so are going to lose their coverage. So this is not just about people on Medicaid.
No, it's about all of us. It's easy to target one segment, and you're right. This is what they're doing, going after that one segment. It is all of us, and it's kind of the slippery slope argument I was making. But Andrea, I appreciate you keeping us up to date, and I don't really look forward to talking to you again because this isn't good news. We have to come back and talk about something much happier and better about health policy, about people getting better. You know, maybe in 2028, 2029, we'll have something better to talk about.
Sounds lovely.
Thanks so much. Andrea Dukas, Vice President of Health Policy there at the Center for American Progress. I want to hear your thoughts. What do you think? Is this going to affect you if they do this? And is it direct, or is it one of those, well, you know, you're going to pay more, you're going to get less services, or your local hospital is going to close down? I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Right back.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Cloudy sky tonight, areas of rain and lows falling down to the low 40s. For tomorrow, more clouds, showers gradually diminishing but staying breezy, high mid-50s. Sunshine returns for Thursday and Friday, and warmer, highs low 60s. Currently, it's 44 degrees.
You know that tune. You're a star. You know stuff. Why not win stuff? Maybe it's stuff about TV or movies, but still, you shine at useless information, and WFHR and Culver's want to reward you.
Welcome back.
Join the morning show Fridays for a chance to win one value basket and a kid's meal. Be our next superstar with Culver's Star of the Day every Friday at 97.5 FM WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
And again, I go back to this slippery slope argument because, look, I've got the best health care money can buy. You know, the reality is my Teamsters union negotiates the best health care benefits that you can probably get in this country. And look, union members across the country have fabulous health care because they pay for it. They negotiate for it. They force employers to provide it. But if you're in a rural area like I'm in, you know, what happens if that local hospital goes belly up because you've pulled all of this resource out and now they've got to do an enormous amount of uncompensated care? What happens if you've got this great card, but nowhere to go? Do you have anything? So here to share some thoughts on that, I've asked Stephanie Teachman to come talk with us. She works for the SUNY Fredonia College in New York. She's a Civil Service Employees Association union member. I was on the Hill lobbying to save Medicaid kind of because of just what I said. Stephanie, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, you know, I asked the question, you know, if you've got great insurance and there's nowhere to go, you know, what good is it if there's nowhere to take that card and get that insurance? And you were on the Hill, you know, kind of making that argument, right?
Right. Yeah, I think people don't really realize that if you're in a more populated area, you have access to quite a few hospitals. I live in a rural community in Chautauqua County. We had one hospital already closed 5 years ago because of budget issues, which is actually the hospital that's closest to me. So now I drive 20 minutes to the next closest hospital. And if that one were to close for some reason, the next closest would be more than 40 minutes probably. And then it's an hour or more, depending on which direction you want to drive into.
Right. And as the dominoes fall, look, you know, maybe that hospital goes belly up or the one next to it. Who knows how bad this gets? And you could end up, well, not having anywhere to go. Like, I look at my friends in Perry County just to my north, and they don't even have a hospital. They've got medical centers in the whole county.
Right. And I think You know, sometimes people don't consider the fact that while we do have hospitals, they're not necessarily like fully functional in the way that people expect. For instance, if you're in a severe accident in our area, you actually get flown out to a different county for trauma, or down into Pennsylvania, which is problematic because while you might have great insurance here, it doesn't always transfer to another state over.
So as you lay this out, you, like I said, you were up on the Hill, you were making that argument to representatives. What did the folks in Congress have to say? What kind of response did you get as you laid this out?
So, I mean, I think there are some people who are understanding. A lot of the people on the Democratic side, you know, they, I think, really heard our stories and have empathy for us. Actually, AOC mentioned my district when she was talking. District 23. However, other politicians don't seem to want to hear us. For instance, my Congressman Nick Langworthy, I didn't even get a chance to speak with him or even have his staff like come and talk to me.
Cowards.
So, which, I mean, I'm not really surprised because I have like called his office before and I have written emails and I showed up at a rally outside his office and he's never really around. I don't think he actually wants to hear from people who live in his district who have a different opinion than what he currently holds.
Yeah, when you've got an ideology to uphold, because look, you know, the argument that is made is we've got to save money and we got to save money somewhere, Stephanie. And, you know, letting poor people die, that's, you know, that's one way, right?
Right. And I mean, that's really unfortunate that they're willing to do that just to give their billionaire friends a tax break.
So now when you're talking to your fellow union members or your people in your neighborhood, are they getting this? Is this filtering down, or has the narrative been so well laid out that it's just these handful of cheats or these people who, you know, they're gaming the system? So what are you hearing?
I do think there are a lot of people who believe the line that it's just waste and fraud that people are really combating. But I think, you know, unions like mine, CSEA, and then also AFSCME are doing a really great job of putting info out there, letting people know who might also be impacted. You know, I think a lot of people don't recognize that rural hospitals rely heavily on Medicaid funding, and also a lot of my members' jobs. So not at SUNY Fredonia, but we have state members in the psych centers, and we have county people in nursing homes and the Department of Social Services. All those people's jobs also rely on Medicaid funding. So if they were to experience cuts, like it could be your friend, your neighbor who loses their job. And people are starting to realize that because of what the unions have been putting out.
You know, I've taken the position, you know, since the election day that, you know, we're going to have to learn the hard way of what government does and what we want. And while there's going to be a lot of pain and suffering, and there will be, that the solutions will come out of the savagery. The more things that they break, the more things that they destroy, it will pull us hopefully together in a way that we decide where we want to go. And we bring these things back in a more robust way. But it's getting through this, because I don't think we're going to stop the Medicaid cuts. I think it's going to happen. I think it's just a matter of making sure that everyone understands exactly what's happening, and we begin to organize around that. I'm curious if you have any thoughts.
I think that's probably true. You know, people don't really see the effects until it affects them personally, which is really unfortunate, because I'd rather not have to live through it. But I do think, you know, you're right that we won't be able to stop it necessarily, but now it's really about educating people, and hopefully we can get more members to turn out for the vote, and get some better people who are looking out for the working class.
Yeah. Cause I've been saying here recently that, you know, Doge Boy and his ferrets came into office believing that they were going to be able to cut $2 trillion worth of waste, fraud, and abuse from our government. And then they're like, well, no, that was just a goal. Now we'll get a trillion. And now they're claiming somewhere around $150 billion. And there's even questions of any of that. And I'm arguing that it's going to probably cost us three times that much once we figure out what they've broken. But in looking at this, shouldn't the education process be going, hey, you know, for all of the talk of things not working, we do a pretty good job of the government to ensure that people aren't dying in the streets, that our money's spent reasonably well, considering Doge Boy and his ferrets couldn't find anything. Shouldn't that start to be the message that, look, you know, these programs are the backstop for everything else that we do. And when we destroy this, everything else comes down with it. Any thoughts?
I mean, I agree. I think, you know, Elon Musk has done a horrible job of finding waste and fraud. I mean, really.
He's done a great job. It's not there. It's not the, you know, this giant hole, this office with the golden door doesn't exist.
Exactly. And I mean, I think, you know, it's really the responsibility of the government to take care of the citizens that live in the country. And, you know, we pay our taxes and we deserve to be supported. We deserve to have access to things like healthcare and, you know, safety nets. And that's just how it should be. You know, I mean, billionaires have had advantages already. I don't really think they need more.
Yeah. No, see, I don't want to push back too hard. I don't think we deserve anything. I think it's our right. There's a huge difference. Deserve sounds like I'm in some kind of entitlement. Social Security is my right. I paid into it. Being at life, liberty, pursuit of happiness is my right. That's what we should be demanding. And what these clowns are doing right now in D.C. and what they're planning to do to poor working class people should be front and center on everybody's tongue. And we should be hammering against them at every opportunity so that when the bad stuff happens, we know who to point the fingers at.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And what's that guy's name again that your congressman, Leachman or Lickman or what? What's his name?
It's Nick Langworthy.
Yeah, whatever. Leachman, Worthy, whatever. Yeah. Now, this is where my frustration is, because we've got these bunch of no-names who nobody's heard of, but they're doing horrible stuff, and they keep getting away with it, and they keep staying there because we don't exercise our right to throw the bums out.
Right.
So last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, then you start looking at, you know, okay, how do we organize around this? What's AFSCME doing? What's your union, CSEA, doing? What are the folks doing to get the members motivated and mobilized, educated, active, and engaged? What are you guys doing?
I mean, so they put out a bunch of informational email blasts. CSEA specifically, like, I'm designated as a federal political action liaison now. So I get information and I share it with people in my district. So I think it's really just a matter of informing. So we've been collecting emails, you know, and trying to encourage people to not only like read them, but also to go out and do like action items for us, like attending rallies, or, you know, if you're not comfortable being out in the spotlight, you know, you can just write an email to your congressman, or you can phone their office. You know, really it's just getting out there, making your voice heard, and, you know, showing them that we are here and we exist, and, you know, we're looking for these changes, and hopefully, you know, they'll start listening to us.
Now, the other side of that is, you know, there's an election coming up not too far down the road. Is that part of this game plan as well? Because, look, I don't think these cuts are popular. I don't think this big, beautiful bill is popular. It's a bunch of big, beautiful bull. I don't think it's popular, and I think if you can organize around it, maybe we grab back some power and we change some stuff. So are you organizing for that as the end road goal? Thoughts?
Yeah, I think we do that as well, right? We have political action committees that do endorsements. So obviously we're keeping an eye on candidates. Honestly, Nick Langworthy has never sought our endorsement. But I'm hopeful that, you know, maybe someone will stand up and run against him and we can put that candidate forward in our district instead. But, you know, right, we're really looking to bring in some candidates who support labor, whether they're Republican or Democrat. You know, we're just looking for people who stand with us and share the same ideals that we should have.
Yeah, maybe that this person I know named Stephanie Teachman.
Maybe.
Okay, that's good. It's the first step. I've had a lot of people go, no, absolutely not. But maybe he's a good start. I'll tell you what I tell everybody. I'll send you your first donation because we need good, strong opinionated, family values kind of working folks in the halls of power if we're going to take this country in the right direction. But Stephanie, I appreciate the time. Keep up the great work and hope to talk to you again real soon.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much, Stephanie. Stephanie Teachman. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at therickSmithshow.com. You worried about the hospital in your neighborhood? Because, again, they take this key component away. What happens to everybody else? I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at therickSmithshow.com. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day that workers at the Jones and Laughlin plant in Aliquippa, Pennsylvania, voted in the first ever union election in the United States steel industry under the National Labor Relations Board. The National Labor Relations Act had been passed 2 years earlier, guaranteeing workers the right to join and form a union. But the steel industry had long stood against union organizing. In Pennsylvania, anti-union bosses in steel and coal often had the backing of the state militia. Workers who dared to talk union were harassed and fired. George Laughlin, a steel worker at Jones and Laughlin, found out just how far the company would go to keep the union out of their plant. When George was injured on the job, he took up a part-time job organizing. The company pulled strings and had him committed to the state's lunatic asylum. He was only released after the governor intervened. Governor Griffin Pinchot was a progressive who dared to stand up to the steel companies. The passage of the National Labor Relations Act gave workers the support of the federal government to stand up for their rights as workers. After the votes were counted, it was declared that the workers had overwhelmingly chosen the Steel Workers Organizing Committee, or SWOC, as their bargaining agent. Jones and Laughlin agreed to rehire the workers that had been fired due to their union activity. They also had to pay these workers back pay. And the company agreed to sit down and bargain with the union. The next year, the giant of the steel industry, U.S. Steel, signed its first contract with SWOC. Union recognition had finally come to the steel mills.
Well, what did Jones and Laughlin steal? Pittsburgh.
Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, I go back to this Medicaid thing, which again is a huge thing for me. Ideologically, first and foremost, because it's something that I've been fighting for years. We've marched in capitals, we've marched in streets, we've lobbied, we've done all kinds of things over the years to protect Medicaid, because I understand it's that last line of social safety net. And now more recently, because my wife is probably going to have to have that for the rest of her life because of the traumatic brain injury from the motorcycle accident back in September. While I would love to say she's becoming her again, she's not. And she's never going to be the person she was. She's never going to be able to work. She's never going to be able to do the things she did before. So what, as a society, are we going to do with her? Would you let her die? In the event that something happens to me, what happens to her? And this is where I make this argument about the slippery slope. Look, we're deciding what life looks like in our household going forward on how we're going to care for mom and how we're going to care for my wife, how we're going to do that. And Medicaid is going to play a part of that. If you're slashing that down to nothing, what happens to her? And the thing is, you know, cutting Medicaid, cutting that funding may sound, we're just looking at budgets. And for some, it's a budgetary or ideological correction, an effort to reduce government spending or shift healthcare responsibilities, you know, back to the private market where it should be. However, this, I got to tell you, this is going to set off a dangerous chain reaction across the entire economy. This is not merely a political shift. It is the first push down a steep, steep, slippery slope that threatens not just the health of low-income Americans, as I've been saying, but the stability of the entire healthcare economy, the entire sectors of the U.S. economy that depends on healthcare spending. At the core of this threat is a fundamental misunderstanding. The government, through programs like Medicaid, they act as an indispensable backstop for private interests. Removing that support, removing that entire system, will then teeter on collapse. As I've been saying, if you pull that money out of these hospitals, you pull that money out of care, what happens? Medicaid provides health insurance for over 75 million people in this country. Children, pregnant women, elderly individuals, people like my wife with disabilities now. A cut in Medicaid funding leads directly to reducing access to essential medical services for all these groups. All of these folks are going to suffer. But again, I come back to it's the hospitals, particularly rural hospitals, and what we call safety net hospitals. Ones in high poverty areas that aren't turning a big profit that the profiteers and the for-profit folks want. Understand, a drop in funding means that either they're going to scale back their services, close their ERs, you know, be sorely. Go back to when I was a kid in the 70s. You would go to the free clinic and you'd be there all day. You'd be there for hours just to see something simple. So that drop in funding is going to mean scale back in services. Or worse, it's going to mean you're going to close them entirely. Pushing, well, sick people, patients into more expensive emergency care and forcing them to delay with massive treatments or, you know, things getting worse, just not getting cared for, which again will cost us more in the long run. Everything Republicans throw at us is penny wise and pound foolish. And we used to understand that. I remember as a kid, you know, there was a commercial back in the 70s and 80s. Pay me now or pay me later. You can pay me a little bit now to fix it right, do it while it's still a small problem, or down the road when it's blossomed into a much bigger problem. And this is what Trump and the Republicans and Elon and the Doge ferrets, this is what they're doing. They're claiming we're going to save you short-term money. We got the short-term fix for you. And like any addicts, we're gonna grab for it. And it's going to cost so much more in the long run. But understand, when they cut this, there will be a strain on the healthcare system. Hospitals are going to lose Medicaid support, and they are going to close. They are going to consolidate. They are going to privatize. They're going to do all the things that's already happening because we're gutting funding to it. And the goal, to save money by rationing care. Again, what they tell us those universal systems do. So what do we know is going to happen? Well, we know it's going to happen. You're going to see increased ER traffic, increased wait times. You're going to drive up the cost for everybody who has private insurance. So we're going to complain about that. You're going to see providers raise their rates just to cover the unreimbursed care. You're going to see, again, we've seen this cycle. And then employers, they're going to have to pay more for health plans, which means lower wages or reductions in coverage, which means more rationing for everybody. Yeah, the economic effect is going to be massive. The damage will spread. Families will pay higher premiums, higher deductibles, and have less disposable income, which is, again, going to reduce, we know this, going to reduce consumer spending, which, you know, the backbone of the U.S. economy. Small businesses are already operating on narrow margins. They're already unable to keep up with the rising cost of insurance. And maybe, again, you know, make cut jobs altogether. Where are the Republicans with this argument? I know when we talk about raising the minimum wage, boy, they're first, it's going to cost jobs. This is going to cost jobs. This is going to cause more monopolization. Because the big boys, the big companies, the Walmarts, the big boys, they're going to either be able to absorb some of those costs. Or they're just going to, nothing. And understand, most of the people who are on Medicaid right now, you know, the 92% of the Medicaid recipients who are working in low-wage industries like retail and food service, where the benefits aren't there anyway, which, again, going to cause this much worsening economic situation. And look, economic insecurity will increase. Job losses will increase. All of this stuff then will cost us more in public programs, straining our resources at the government level even more. And ultimately, as I said a moment ago, costing us more. So penny wise, pound foolish. Understand, Medicaid is not simply a health program. It is a public insurance system that absorbs risk across the economy and costs that the private sector are either unwilling or unable or more unwilling to take on. We, as our government, the safety net programs, take on the most costly folks. The people in the first 5 years, the people in their last 5 years of life. That's when we use healthcare the most. It's when it's the most expensive. And yet, somehow, we've set up a system where the private interest, the moneyed interest, get the healthy people. And now we're saying we don't care about the young, the old, the sick, don't care. Yet we're a Christian nation. I'm telling you, it's not great. And what begins as targeting funding cuts will quickly spiral into the erosion of what is the fundamental pillar of what supports our healthcare and our labor market. And as we allow government to and Republicans continue to withdraw from being that backstop, what you're going to see is an economic calamity. Healthcare costs are going to surge. Public health is going to deteriorate. It's all bad. Workforce productivity is going to fall. All things that we don't want. Workers are going to miss more days. Chronic illnesses are going to go untreated. All the bad stuff. And they seem to be okay with it. And this is one of those things where we as citizens have to figure out, you know, what is the role of Medicaid and understand it. What's going on right now, it reveals that Medicaid and look, government intervention more broadly serves as the keystone, the arch of the American economic life. If we tear this out, it's trouble. It really is. And look, as I said, you know, the slippery slope starts with cutting Medicaid. But it doesn't end with balanced budgets or personal responsibility. It ends with a fractured economy. It ends with crumbling infrastructure. It ends with millions of Americans worse off financially, physically, socially, all of that. The private sector is built on the assumption that government will carry certain burdens, that we, the people, will carry certain burdens, especially when it comes to, you know, the general welfare of we, the people. And removing that support removes the foundation upon which most markets rest. And once that first step's taken, once we cross over that threshold, it's going to be really hard. It's going to be really hard to stop. And the reality is, we've already seen a lot of this play out. Because there were states that didn't expand Medicaid. And immediately they started seeing rural hospitals closing down because you had more people who didn't have care because Medicaid was always the backstop. Now with the expansion, you have fewer people who had insurance because states didn't create that exchange. So Medicaid expansion was denied. Rural hospitals lost revenue. Bad things happened. Hospitals began to close. Bad things happened. Patients had to travel farther. Local economies suffered. Job losses happened across the economy. The private insurers increased costs. We all have heard this. And now you've got Republicans who are saying, nope, we're okay with that. We want more just so we can get our penny. And it's going to cost society a pound. Are you okay with that? And if you're not, something to be angry about. Something to reach out to your legislator about, especially if you got a Republican. because they're the ones ramming this down our throats. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Matt Piper. Millions are under severe weather threats tonight with the risk of tornadoes, including places that just saw some over the weekend. CBS News meteorologist David Parkinson with who needs to be on the lookout.
Anywhere from Memphis all the way to Nashville, we've already had reports of several tornadoes, and two of them were confirmed by weather spotters. So we know that we've had tornadoes on the ground, and we expect that threat through at least 8 p.m. Central tonight. And we could see in eastern Tennessee a threat as late as 9, 10, or 11 p.m.
At least 29 people died from storms this past weekend. In New Orleans, police have arrested a jail maintenance worker in connection with the escape of 10 inmates. A fifth has just been caught tonight. CBS's Katie Weiss.
Authorities say that 33-year-old Sterling Williams helped the inmates make their daring escape by turning off the water supply to the facility so that way the inmates could more easily remove